101, Book 5, Essential Vulgarity, in which archaic intolerances are presented with the most sophisticated means by modern actors with a modern agenda.
102. Unlike Europeans who fantasized about rural utopias, the slave-owning Thomas Jefferson never rejected technology along with the city. On the contrary, the sage of Monticello was an enthusiastic proponent of technological innovation. Crucially, he believed it was possible to freeze the social development of the United States.
103. A selective approach to tradition invariably has some ultra-critical joker concealed in it. Northrop Frye, Anatomy of Criticism, 1957. Description of an ISIS video of the execution of 121 Christian Copts on a beach in the New York Times of 2015. The waves lap languidly against the coastline as flickering spectral images crackle back and forth across screen. A seemingly endless parade of black-clad assassins, each leading his own sacrificial victim, flies across the beachfront in a skillful montage with multiple angles, overhead shots, and rapid MTV-style editing. The camera lingers on the terror of the victims' faces. They're pushed face down into the sand and gruesomely decapitated, each man's severed head being placed on top of his torso. The sea is seen as running with blood. With soft focus, slow fades, colour saturation, superimpositions and carefully layered soundtracks, the most effective videos are haunting. Its fighters seem to hover spectral and luminous as if holy or angelic. They offer to transport the audience into an imaginary prophetic space, redeeming history, the conflation of millenarian yearning with contemporary grievances.
104. It was tradition for Japanese warriors to return with the heads of their slain enemies and present them to the emperor. In the invasion and terrorizing of Korea at the end of the 16th century, they killed so many that transport became a problem. Instead, they cut off their ears and noses to confirm their deeds and receive rewards. The facial parts were put in barrels of brine and returned to the imperial capital. Because many barrels were discarded, it will never be known how many Koreans perished in Hideyoshi's invasions. Historians have estimated anywhere between 40,000 and 1,000,000 on the Korean side alone. Nose tombs, as war trophies, were created to bury the Korean body parts. One such nose tomb was discovered in 1983 in Okayama near Osaka. This tomb held the served and pickless noses of approximately 20,000 dead Koreans, which were eventually returned to Korea in 1992 and cremated.
105. In the 16th century, St. Francis Xavier spent a lot of time on his feet, spreading the gospel throughout Spain, France, Italy, Malaysia, Japan, Sri Lanka, and India, dying at sea en route to China. When a group of Christians disinterred his body a few months later, they were surprised to see it in a perfect state of preservation. But just as in life, his quote-unquote incorrupt body didn't stay at rest for long. In the first public exhibition of his corpse in Goa, India, in a fit of reverence, a Portuguese woman bit off his big toe. Allegedly, the toe gushed blood and she was caught when people followed the grisly trail to her home. Today, St. Francis Xavier's toe is on display in a silver reliquary in a cathedral in Goa. And it isn't the only part of St. Xavier's corpse to travel. There's a diamond-encrusted fingernail on display in a different village in Goa. Part of an arm was sent to Rome, and there's a hand in Japan.
106. Towards the end of the 1980s, using Slobodan Milosevic's rise to power, using a rhetoric of Serbian nationalism, a new musical genre called turbo folk, mixing traditional music with rap styles and Western dance music, became dominant. Singers compared themselves to military commanders when the rhetoric turned into real war with the assault on Bosnia. Its use of folk music and lyrics from Serbian medieval poetry, like that describing King Lazar, killed by the invading Turks in 1389, the country as the victim needing to be protected, was not unique. On the eve of war, Ivo Zanik writes, "Fiddling in Yugoslavia became like a press center with a reliable translation service that was in charge of translating the current political messages of Serb leaders into old epic images, and vice versa. War photographers often portrayed fiddlers accompanying Serb militiamen. The Belgrade newspaper Borba quoted the president of the Fiddlers Association saying, "When one says fiddler, one hears the words struggle and freedom. War is for us a kind of professional training." The most notorious of these militiamen was the armed criminal Arkon, leader of the Serbian Volunteer Guard paramilitary unit. His marriage to the turbo folk singer Čeča in 1995 was a massive public spectacle broadcast live on national television and radio. A mayor of Port Empedocle, the Sicilian birthplace of the playwright Pirandello, was under pressure to erect a statue of him, but did not have the money to do so. On a twin city trip somewhere in Ukraine, he saw many discarded statues on the ground that showed a man with a bald head and slanted eyes, very similar to Pirandello. He was told that he could have as many as he wanted without any payment. So it was that after some slight changes, Lenin's stone face became Pirandello's and was erected in the square of his hometown.
107.
Alfred Stieglitz, definer of the woman modernist and programmer of modernism, put on a 1914 New York show called Statuary in Wood by African Savages, The Root of Modern Art, with Marius Desayas. Desayas published with it an essay, Modern Art in Connection with Negro Art, in which the African Negro was caricatured as childlike and living in a world of fear, teaching modernists merely how to express their subjectivity, our purely sensorial feelings in regard to form. But he characterized it as a barbarous art that bypassed analysis and observation for the intense expression of the inner life. At the same time, in Germany, artists of both the expressionist and anti-expressionist objectivist school had a generic view of primitive art with which to challenge both industrialization and bourgeois art. But in so doing, they mixed in the art of ancient America along with African, oceanic, and that of the insane and children. The art of these other parts of the world were allowed no history, aesthetic, or dynamics of their own culture. Instead, Paul Klee talked of a universal primitivism, and with an eye on shifting trends in the art world, Oskar Schlemmer, appointed to the Bauhaus in 1920, reported that the Indian and Oriental concept is having its heyday in Germany.
108. It then turned out that there were the primitive and the primitive. As a dimension of European modernisms, it was necessarily divided into what could be claimed as good and bad models, usually ethnically defined. There were souped-up versions of the noble savage, which lauded notions of purity and authenticity. But as complicit with European colonialism, it depended on notions of backwardness in the colonized world. The career of Rudolf von Laban reveals both how this divide was articulated and the hole into which the contradiction fell. As the head of German Tanzbühne, an official organization in the Nazi period sponsored by Joseph Goebbels, von Laban was organizing a huge dance pageant to accompany the Berlin Olympiad of 1936. Back in 1913, he had set up a dance company and an alternative community in the Swiss mountain town of Ascona, where he ran summer schools for students and admirers. Doubling up as psychosomatic healer, which writes at sunrise and sunset, and with an anti-machine civilization ideology. His notion of healthy primitivism was selective, but common to Germany after the First World War. He idealized the same North American natives that were popularized in the best-selling novels of Karl May. Their dance, he wrote, never leads to frenzy. The posture often remind one of Greek or Asian sculpture. The grotesqueness is not unsophisticated or evil in nature, whereas he doubts whether the American Negro is capable of inventing any dance at all. The Negro adopts our dance inventions and uses them grotesquely. And then he goes on to complain that the white race has readopted distortions of its own dances, only shows the lack of taste at the robot age. Rudolf von Laban, A Life for Dance, 1975. His career reveals how the counterculture of Ascona evolved into Nazism in its attack on the degeneration of white cosmopolitan culture was not an uncommon trajectory in this period, but Laban has misunderstood the real nature of German National Socialism. Despite the penchant for Wagner, mysticism and mountaintops, in fact, fully embraced the robot age of industrial civilization as well as master race ideology.
109. However overblown and anachronistic Nazi ideology seemed, it was no obstacle to the modernization of society and the economy. Traditional concepts like race, blood, and soil were gradually imbued with new meaning by social scientists, economists, and agrarian experts. According to them, true Germans were no longer distinguished primarily by certain outward characteristics, but by their capacity for work and their willingness to conform.
110. Goebbels watched the dress rehearsal of the Dance Olympiad and did not like the pagan spectacle. Its presentation at the Olympic Games was cancelled, and soon after von Laban was himself denounced as hostile to the state. Leni Riefenstahl fared rather better. Her choreographing of the whole Olympic spectacle using the von Laban associate and her own dance teacher, Mary Wigman, was deemed a success because of how it referenced the aesthetics of ancient Greece as invented by the German. Leni Riefenstahl went on to make more films about the Nuba people of Sudan in the early 60s, and although the Nuba are black, not Aryan, Riefenstahl's portrayal of them evokes some of the larger themes of Nazi ideology. The contrast between the clean and the impure, the incorruptible and the defiled, the physical and the mental, the joyful and the critical. Ofra, Goldstein, Sidoni, Construction of Gendered and Cultural Identities, Ethnologue, 1999.
111. The distinction between modernity and tradition is profoundly unhelpful as a way of understanding the social changes flowing from the accelerated integration of capitalist markets. Radhika Desai, Slouching Towards Ayuda, 2002. The deployment of the language of particularity, of cultural difference and nationalism in counterfeit answer to the accelerating universalism of capitalism, which it supports and promotes, is the ingenious reality of the right today. Neo-Gandhianism emerged within the intellectual reconstitution of the global new right in the 1980s and 90s, which typically conceived of culture as disembodied rather than incarnated in society's material, productive and reproductive processes.
112. The use of granite Ten Commandments being displayed in U.S. state courthouses dates back to Cecil B. DeMille's film of the same name in 1956 when, as a publicity stunt, he had hundreds of tablets placed in public spaces and buildings like courthouses across the country. It confirmed American exceptionalism to be one of a chosen people, confirmed by the mandatory schoolroom reverence for the Stars and Stripes flag.
113. The present-day BJP Hindu nationalist government of India has made this real, backed as it is by the RSS, an armed Hindu nationalist group with this mythic Vedic Golden Age conception, one codified and constructed from many different ritual and social religious hierarchies by Orientalists like Max Müller, whose translation of the Rig Veda is seen as authentic founding literature. The RSS leadership claims that there are no minorities in India where all people are culturally, nationally, and DNA-wise Hindus. While pushing a neoliberal agenda, the ruling BJP has remained silent and ungiving on its role in the massacre of Muslims at Ayodhya. This was instigated by a double claim that Ram, the human hero in an oral tale Ramayana, was the paramount god in the Hindu pantheon, and that there had been a temple to him that had been demolished in 1528 to become the site of the Babri Masjid Mosque. In 1990, the desire to reconstruct a temple there was expressed by the Hindu nationalists. Ram was reimagined as a bare-chested Rambo with bow and arrow, and despite the Archaeological Survey of India's assertion that there was no evidence for the site claims, in December 2002, 150,000 to 200,000 RSS volunteers began to stone and then smash up the mosque. Some 1,200 Muslims were subsequently killed. British colonialists, keen to encourage both Indian exoticism and the caste system, also institutionalized communal politics in strategic fashion. Their reforms deepened religious sectarianism by establishing separate Muslim and Hindu constituencies. Then, in 1947, with independence imminent, the British government sent a lawyer, Sir Cyril Radcliffe, to divide India on these lines. He had 3 months to make a 6,000-kilometre boundary. He did the job with no knowledge of India, and he refused to use updated geographic surveys. The result was the largest migration in history and bloody violence in the new border areas, with as many as a million murdered in communal violence. 114. Hasan Manto, Doba Tek Singh, 1948. 2 or 3 years after partition, the governments of Pakistan and India decided that just as there had been cordial exchanges of prisoners, there should now be a similar exchange of lunatics. That is to say, Muslim lunatics housed in Indian asylums should be repatriated to Pakistan, and Sikh and Hindu lunatics, in turn, handed over to India. One cannot speak for the other side, but here in Lahore, a lively debate began at the lunatic asylum when news of the transfer broke out. When one Muslim lunatic asked, "Maulvi Sab, what is Pakistan?" another replied after careful deliberation, "An area of India where razor blades are manufactured." This explanation seemed to satisfy his friend, Similarly, one Sikh lunatic said to another, Sardarji, why are we being sent to India? We don't even speak their language. The other said with a smile, I speak Hindustanese, and let me tell you, they're very wicked people.
115.
The political instability, which was characteristic of previous governments and seriously impeded the effectiveness of US efforts in Pakistan, has been replaced by a relatively stable martial law regime. The present political situation should be conducive to the furtherance of US objectives. In view of the present stability, even though achieved by fiat, the problem has changed from one of short-term urgency to one which allows us to take a longer-range view of Pakistan's potential. USA National Security Council, 1958.
116. Some 20 years later, there was another military coup and subsequent martial law regime of General Zia-ul-Huq, under which GDO growth was the highest in the country's history. At the same time, the regime replaced the Pakistan Penal Code with the Hudud Ordinance, whereby theft, punishments of imprisonment or fine, were replaced by hand or foot amputations and adultery punished by flogging, 100 lashes, for the unmarried and stoning to death for married offenders. Rape victims were also punished. In 21st century Pakistan, young women of the consumer-oriented, tradition-based bourgeoisie, beneficiaries of General Zia's economy, have rejected the indiscriminate egalitarianism and delight of the Islamic mazars, where their mothers are likely to have gone for intercession with saints. Instead, they have opted for dars, institutions for serious Quran study. The Al-Huda school of Islam, in which anti-USA sentiment sits comfortably with the consumerist ethic, has been especially attractive to this class and generation of women. The Al-Huda school was founded in 1994 by two PhDs from Glasgow University, Scotland. Their school is intolerant of all festivals, mazars, Indians, and Shiite Muslims.
117. The Valle de los Caídos between Madrid and Segovia is the fascist monument that the dictator Franco had built after his victory to honor the fallen Falanges and to serve as his future mausoleum. Built is the wrong word. He let it be driven into a granite cliff by slave and forced labor, a space twice the size of the Notre Dame in Paris, one of the largest mausoleums in the world, and most certainly a spiritual one, too, a mine in the form of a cathedral. At the end of the gigantic cavern, in a papally acknowledged basilica, Franco's grave is today located. Upon this grave, even now, 30 years after the end of the fascist dictatorship, fresh flowers are laid daily by the father of the adjacent cloister, and daily masses are read for the dead dictator. Before my eyes, a father performed the transubstantiation, raised the chalice as if he wanted to toast the dictator, and drank the blood of Christ. Since the 1st of January, 28, the glorification of Franco has been prohibited in Spain, but not visits to his mausoleum or the reading of mass before his grave. Robert Manasse, Utopia, 2009.